Welcome to the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. We are your hosts, Martijn Bron and Alexander Sterk.
Welcome with another Strong Source Commodity Podcast, and I'm very happy to have a very special guest today. Someone who I was very much impressed with when I worked in Cargill. While we didn't even work with each other and I didn't know her that long, but the first time I basically met her over a Teams call, I was extremely impressed. Yeah, the more I learned about her, that only increased. And we have now good traction with the podcast. We have had some really great guests already. And some of the feedback from our audience was, hey, look, why don't you invite a female trader? And we said, yeah, I mean, we really want to do that. But it's not so easy to find female traders and traders that are in a really senior position and work in an incredible company. So one of the best traders I know, and she's a woman. And I like her. I'm really impressed with her. So let's ask Christine Engman, who has worked for 19 years in Cargill and left last year. So I'm extremely happy that you want to participate with us.
Indeed. I mean, it's fantastic. And also don't forget American, right? So it's good that we have people from all over the world in our podcast. So I'm very happy, Christine, that you're here. And also, again, a fantastic track record, fantastic trader. So I'm very much looking forward to the cool stories that you will have to bring for our audience. So welcome.
Yeah, so basically start with the easy question. Could you briefly introduce yourself? And then we'll take it from there.
Absolutely. Well, thank you both, Alex and Martijn, for inviting me to this podcast. I was really looking forward to it and very honored to be the first female on your podcast. So a little bit about me. I am American. I was born and raised in a small town in northern Minnesota, which is where I grew up. I went to college actually to be a math teacher. So if you look back to my early ages as to how I came into trading, I was always really good in math and the sciences, which also as a female was not something that most females were traditionally strong. And so I went to be a math teacher because I actually wanted to influence females in being really strong in mathematics. And throughout college, I pivoted, took some fun accounting and finance classes, which most people laugh at because most people don't enjoy accounting and finance classes, and fell in love with the business world. I actually knew nothing about Cargill. I knew nothing about trading, but my first internship out of college was with Cargill as a junior credit analyst. And so that is how I started. And back then, the credit analysts for our energy group in Minneapolis were based on the center of the trade floor. So my first experience in Cargill was seated in the center of the trade floor, no females, just all men. And then me as a junior credit analyst, where all day long, the traders were asking me to extend their credit lines and make sure that the credit was good for the trades that they were making. I was hired then full time as an accountant. And I said yes, because I had so thoroughly enjoyed my internship. And about a week in doing debits and credits in a tall cube, not in that trading environment, I decided I really wanted to get back to that type of environment. That gave me energy, probably because I grew up playing a lot of sports and I really liked that competitive, energetic environment. And so I put my stake out there that said I wanted to be a trader. And how could I do that? And a year later, they had a couple entry-level positions open on our real-time energy trading desk. And I think partially by luck, partially by persistence, as I had been spending every waking moment learning trading and spending time with the traders and finding projects to get on with the traders so I would start to learn it, I got one of those two roles. And so that's how I initially got into trading. I had to explain to my parents that real-time traders, yes, I was in a corporate environment, but I was working weekends and holidays and nights and all the crazy things. But that was my first foray into trading. We'll probably get into it later, but Cargill didn't have a huge footprint in energy. And so I say I really cut my teeth in merchandising 101 in energy trading because we did not have a lot of assets to fall back on. And so trading and merchandising was a big part of my job. And I spent the next 10 years in energy trading, working my way up. Ironically, it's where I started having a family as well. Every time I came back from maternity leave, I ended up with a bigger job, which does not normally happen to females, but that is, if you look back at my career, how I moved up the chain in energy trading, and obviously I was performing. And then from there, about 10 years into my career, I was asked to take a step out of trading for a year. actually, and go and acquire some of the investment bank's physical books for Cargill on the energy space. I did not want to do it, but I got some really great advice from people much smarter than I was at the time to showcase that I could be more than just a pointy trader and take that job. So I did that for a year, was super successful in acquiring some pretty big books for Cargill. And then I made the move over to agriculture. So that was the big pivot shift. I went back into trading. I had missed it terribly. And I found my way into the corn milling business, where I was the North America trading lead for corn milling. That was definitely one of those big, deep end of the pool, not have a clue what I'm doing moments. Yeah. As I had, despite being from the Midwest, I was from so far north, I had never really stepped foot on a farm. And here I was managing a team of 40 merchants and traders that were buying grain into all of our corn milling assets without really any background in on the agriculture side. But I knew what I was strong at, which was trading and leading teams. And that sort of helped propel me into my next role. So then from there, I went over to the oils business for Cargill, where I was the North America trading lead there. And then from there, my last role at Cargill was I was the global trading director for our oils and fats business. And then as Martijn talked about, I decided to take probably my biggest leap yet. And I left Cargill just shy of a year ago after 19 years. And then on the personal side, which I think isn't often talked about, as I alluded to, I have 4 kids.
Wow.
Who also keep me very busy. So I used to joke that I came to work to relax. And that was my time to relax. And a wonderful husband who is also actually a commodity trader. We met at Cargill. He now works for Macquarie, but he's an energy trader. So I still have a lot of the feel for trading, even if I'm not trading every day on a daily basis anymore.
It's a really impressive career. Eh? It's really, really impressive. And that with 4 kids, I think it's, I can only say I have 3. I hear at home my wife has wishes for 4. So let's see. But I mean, this is really, really impressive. And what I found interesting is, of course, you're a bit from the region where you have also the agricultural products, where maybe agricultural is a bit more already in your DNA than when you would live in Florida or in New York. But how do you get to, like you said, well, as a credit at Cargill, it's like you see it somewhere on university and you're like, oh, that sounds like a good company, I go there. Because we see so many people often by coincidence enter this industry. Was it somebody talking to you? Was it just a pure luck of vacancy that you saw, or?
So it was the first year that Cargill was recruiting at my university. And so many of my classmates were excited, right? And back then, I mean, nothing was electronic, right? You wrote your name down on a piece of paper. You're going to go have this interview. And I had honestly no idea what this company was about, but everyone was very excited that Cargill was coming to our university to recruit for the first time. And so I wrote my name down. There was a list of probably, I don't know, 100 of us that interviewed for 2 openings at Cargill. And it was quite an interview experience. They actually videotaped our interview and then handed us the physical VHS tape. I'm aging myself a bit. And they said, go home, review it. And if you think you can do better, come back. And that was their way of weeding it down from 100 to about, I think, 20 something of us returned the next day. And out of that, two of us were ultimately hired. Actually, both females and both college athletes were the 2 people that they hired from Cargill that year, from my small university, Bemidji State, to come and be interns at Cargill.
So I assume, is Cargill still long in VHS tapes, or is it they do a different way now? But the and what we can say now, I mean, looking already back in your career, maybe it's not final yet, but until now, and you were a global head, why were you so good? What makes you so good at what you do?
I think I look for good people. If you look back at my career, the one thing that I always, at least once I became a people manager, always looked for was good people, people that worked as a team, people that were collaborative. Again, I'll probably go back to all of my time in sports. I feel like you are much stronger as a team building together than doing it alone. But if I think to myself personally, some of the things that I was doing as a kid, I mean, I remember going to, you know, the little cottage grocery store by my house, and I would buy penny candy and I would sell it at the lemonade stand for like 10 cents, right? And so I was already looking for ways to profit. And then as I got a little bit older, I would be selling things at school and at my sports practices that I bought in bulk and sold them individually, you know? And so I think some of those things too, probably before I even realized it, was just my way to find a way to make money and get ahead. I also came from very humble upbringing. My parents didn't have any money to send me to a university. And so I actually made a decision to go to a small university that actually I had so many scholarships for, they gave me a check every semester. So I was able to make money going to college versus end up in debt. And so, you know, a lot of people question, why did you go to, you know, Bemidji State University? Well, I had an athletic scholarship. I had a full tuition scholarship. I had a bunch of other scholarships. I made money and I decided to do that instead of going to a bigger, you know, in the U.S. Division One school and play Division One sports, because I financially thought that that was the smartest thing to do. I think I've always had that nose for money and finding ways to make money. And I think that combined with, I truly believe if you surround yourself with good people, you give people the opportunity to develop, you make them feel supported. I feel like that's the best recipe for success.
Thank you.
Yeah. Now, I want to go back first a bit to your early beginnings. I get a lot of questions, mostly via LinkedIn. You know, how do I break into the industry and what studies do I need to do? And I was replying to a lot of those requests yesterday. I spent most of my day going through a kind of a long list of questions where I didn't have time for. And a regular question is about people who have started as an accountant or have studied accounting, or ask me, hey, look, is that a good base? And I usually say, well, look, if you are a trader, in essence, if you are a trader, you would never think about working as an accountant, yeah? Rightly or wrongly. But the essence of accounting is looking backwards, and the essence of a trader is looking forward. And as a trader, you know, you're supposed to take risk. And as an accountant, yeah, it's more like preventing risk. So how did you manage? And also one other thing is, once you're an accountant, it's difficult to get rid of the label. So how did you do that? How did you make that jump? And in hindsight, do you think it was a problem, or did it actually help you to move into trading?
I might say something controversial here, because I don't think it really matters what your degree is in to whether or not you're a good trader. I think some of the things I just talked about as to looking back and why do I think I was have been a good trader or what makes somebody else? And I've got some specific things too, but I don't know if your degree really matters. I think you need to have a degree. I think you need to be, you know, highly intelligent. I think you need to be very quick-witted. I think you need to be able to decipher large amounts of data and information and synthesize them and make quick decisions, informed quick decisions. But I don't think, you know, I don't really think the degree matters. Accounting, I sort of fell into, right? I went to be a math teacher. I took an accounting class for fun, which nobody normally does that, but it was numbers and I wanted to understand the business world. And the next thing you know, I'm, you know, majoring in accounting. I knew I never wanted to be in public accounting. I still hate doing my own taxes. I knew I didn't want to be an auditor. I don't know if I'm the stereotypical accountant either. I think it was just a foot in the door for me. I do think, though, some of the elements of accounting that haven't been mentioned yet, like having your house in order, is the way that I describe it. I think part of the reason that I'm a good trader is I have my house in order, right? Like, I have good record keeping practices, and I would journal daily about my game plan and then look back and make sure I was executing. And I think some of that, what I've always called trading discipline, probably stems from some of my training in accounting, just because accounting is a very precise science. But other than that, I don't know if accounting, it definitely did not hinder me. And again, I think it was just a foot in the door to what I did for the last 20 years.
It's a good point, as you say. I mean, I don't think it's controversial. And I also think it's good that you emphasize the importance of having your house in order.
Yeah, I thought the same thing.
Yeah. And being a trader, before you even think about, you know, what to do in, when the market opens, understand what your position is. You know, the admin needs to be spot on. Yeah, it needs to be reconciled every time.
But how do you deal with the house in order when, because if you have your own house in order as a single trader, and let's say you only did sunflower oil, or you have what you had in your last role, you did all the oils, the whole fats book. So you have to have your own house, you know, in order, but also all the other houses that you are managing. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, trading discipline was something that, like, it was probably my mantra that my teams probably got a little sick of me saying, but we didn't trade if our house wasn't in order. That's how regimented I was about it. Because at the end of the day, you don't even know if you're adding risk or taking risk away if you don't know what your position is. And if you have a question about that, you have no business trading until you figure out what your position is. And I think that's just a responsible thing to do as a trader. So I would spend a lot of time, especially when I was moving into new roles, really seeking to understand the elements of our position, especially as the roles got bigger and more complex. And as you alluded to, we were trading oils and fats all over the world and in all regions. I think it's just the foundational building blocks of good, successful traders. I also think it helps you avoid some of the pitfalls of surprises that oftentimes, sink really good traders because you had something mismarked or, you thought you had a contract, but you didn't. And so I just think that also sort of is a very easy way to manage your risk because there's so many other elements that can surprise you in the markets. The last thing that you need is a surprise in your position.
Did you had sometimes that your house was in order or wasn't, and then you couldn't trade anything, just was a silent day, let's say, on the trading desk?
Yes, especially as our positions or my roles got bigger, right? Yeah. As you said, very easy when it was my own books. But as I was managing multiple, yes. And it might not be the entire trading desk shut down. And there's obviously things you need to do. I mean, there's constant, constant order flow on both sides that you need to manage. But we weren't taking big positions if we had a problem with, let's just say, palm oil in Malaysia, right? So if there was something off, and we had a pretty good system where we would do trading estimates and we'd get the information from the accountants. And if that seemed off, then we'd investigate. And when there wasn't a rationale for why things were off, we would take more time to investigate it versus just shove it under the rug. Yep. Because I feel like that just multiplies over time.
Because would you say, because you have, you went from energy towards the agricultural side, right?
Mm-hmm.
So on that, I actually have a question like, would you, if you would start in the world of trading, right? You're young and you came out of school and you would like to start this job. Would you start with energy, what is a massive industry, or would you start with agricultural to learn? Or do you say it doesn't really matter, you just start,
I don't think it really matters. And I think that the markets have evolved so much and will continue to evolve that whatever advice I give today might be irrelevant tomorrow, right? I mean, I remember coming from energy to agriculture and one of the business leaders in agriculture told me that energy had nothing to do with agriculture and that my background was irrelevant. And how could my background in trading transmission and transport and, megawatts and MMBTUs have any translation to, rail cars and bushels. And ironically now, a background in energy and agriculture and where green energy is going is probably one of the most, helpful backgrounds to have. And you can see that collision. So I think, a lot of markets have converged over the years and there's a lot more as information is much more readily available than it was, right? I mean, I started trading in the days where we were still faxing our positions, right? So it's the speed of information and therefore the relevance of, an energy market on an agriculture market or vice versa is just much higher, right? And we've seen, headline risk in the political world have a much greater impact than it did even 10 years ago. So back to your question, I don't know if it really matters what commodity that you start in. I do think, and as I mentioned, I listened to some of the other podcasts, I do think cutting your teeth in sort of the cash merchandising space is so critical to having success as a trader. That would probably be my biggest advice. I think just understanding those cash physical markets is a big element that is very hard to replicate if you go straight to the financial side.
I see somebody here talking and saying yes, yes, yes.
It's true. I think it's an excellent point. And also, this is a great opportunity for you, Christine, to explain to the audience what is merchandising. And so what is the difference between merchandising and financial trading?
Yeah, it's a good question. And my answer might be a little bit fuzzy, but in general, right, cash merchandising I think about is the physical trading and movement of goods. And then if you go to pure financial trading, you're trading derivatives on an exchange. However, I do think that there is a blurred line in the middle where often we would have a lot of debate and discussion, in the walls of Cargill, as Martine, and elsewhere. Okay, but if you are really good at cash merchandising, is there an element of that is trading? And if you are hedging your physical position, what part of that is just hedging? What part of that is taking a position? If you choose not to hedge a physical cash position, is that then considered a trade? And I think it's really hard to put a box and parameter around exactly what that is. But what I will say is, when you are taking a position. And whether you were choosing to hedge or not, I think in general, those elements are an informed decision that a trader needs to make. So if you're cash merchandising, meaning you're buying 50 bushels of corn from a farmer and you are feeding your asset, that's probably just cash merchandising because you've got an asset to feed and you need to be able to buy the physical goods or your asset's going to shut down. But if you are going long 50 bushels of corn in December with no physical asset behind it, and your plan is you think, you know, the market's going to go up and you're going to be able to sell it to a middle marketer or competitor or whatever, then to me that borders on the line of it's still cash merchandising, but you're now more taking a trading position because you don't have necessarily that physical backstop. And I think really good cash merchants are those that are willing to take positions where they don't necessarily have that backstop because they're really thinking about how the entire system is working and they're building those elements that you need actually to be very successful financial trader where you're taking positions you may not have a backstop. And it's even harder, as you both probably know, to get out of a physical position if you're wrong, right? And so those lessons can often be a lot more painful, but are really good lessons to learn. So,
and also if the market is very illiquid and you have to go out of physical market, it's also, you know, a shit storm.
Yeah. And
right.
And I think that you learn a lot from merchandising, and that term, I never heard about it before I went to when I started working at Cargill, and they talked about merchants in the beginning. They didn't say traders, but they said merchants. And over time, I understood what they meant, and that is exactly what you say. But you learn a huge amount from the economics of processing commodities. And that also helps you to understand trade flows, and it helps you to understand cash convergence, and you become much more aware of liquidity and things like COVID, for example, as some recent examples, and the war in Ukraine. As a merchant, you immediately start to think in trade flows and optimizing your asset footprint, and that is incredibly interesting. Now, and indeed, what you also said is the debates in Cargill at times, or probably also outside of Cargill, like who is the real the real trader, right? Is it people who can comfortably enjoy a nice processing margin, or is it the traders who start with a blank piece of paper every day? While at the same time, those people who can enjoy the processing margin, they need to make sure that this thing runs 24/7.
For example, what is a physical settlement on a financial product? I mean, it's coming in end-to-end there, for example, right? So then it's not even, you cannot choose.
No, but what I was saying about the assets is that, you know, whether you like it or not, you need to run this thing 24/7. So otherwise, you're going to have a huge amount of stock or stock mismatches, right? It's complicated. And also, I think the margin curve analysis is extremely interesting, Christine, that you you have that capacity. And that's something that I talk about a lot, to be frank. Could you also enlighten us that incredibly important piece of running a commodity trading business? And I think that is often missed by the mainstream media, certainly, but even the financial media, the enormous amount of time that you have spent on thinking, okay, this is my portfolio of assets. Yeah, I can look at my Excel sheet today, buy the raw material and sell it, and that's my margin. But that's not what we do, right? We think about where we are on the margin curve and then determine how we're going to play the different legs. Because that's one of the most interesting, but also one of the most complex and most important tasks of a trading merchandising manager.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you alluded to, I've been a manager of several different businesses with large physical footprints, you know, processors that make a variety of products. And it's extremely complex. If you just think about the far end of the supply chain and the sales side to the consumer, and you think about how consumers' needs and wants have changed over the last 5 years, I mean, since COVID, and even before that, sustainability-wise, they want to know where their food's coming from. They want different products. They want, you know, sustainable supply chains. They want the whole clarity, just that piece of it alone, when you're trying to look at a forecast about what are you making at which plants, how much of each, and then translating that back to the feedstock,
yeah,
right? Before you've even sold these products, and you just look at a snapshot in time on the margin today, just take it out a year. And that margin is going to change every day, right? But you also don't have the certainty necessarily of the sales. For sure, not 100%. Maybe you've got 30% of the book on, 50%, et cetera. But you're making decisions based on the raw material side of things, for example, of how are you going to feed that facility? Just take one facility, for example. And when are you going to secure? Maybe you just want to buy cash basis. Maybe you don't want to go long because you think, you know, you actually think the corn market, we'll just take the corn market, is going to fall. So you don't want to go long futures, but maybe you actually want to go long cash basis from the farmer. And so if you just take that very small snapshot, we'll just talk about like 1 month in time. And then what if you're wrong, right? What if you don't actually sell that product? And again, we're taking this on a large scale, but see, now you're long cash basis for a product that you don't need. And if you have it delivered to the plant, then you're going to go long stock and you might plug because you don't have enough room. And it's very, to your point, Martijn, just in a very small, you know, example, it's incredibly complex. And to boil it down and try to talk about it in a minute or two is very challenging, but there's large teams of people on all parts of that supply chain that you're working with to make it work. And I think, you know, going back to the question you had asked me earlier, Alex, about what's made me successful, I think one of the reasons that I was asked to take some of these leadership roles in trading was not just about my trading record and you know, how I developed traders and the results on the pure trading side, but also how I thought about the entire system and the people that I engaged with across the leadership team from different functions to make that entire system work.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you're not operating on facts, and going back to I like to have my house clean, and you're just operating on assumptions, or you have a salesperson that's really excited and thinks they're going to sell 110% of the capacity and they come in selling 60%, and now you're long and now you're taking massive losses and maybe the market's in an inverse. I mean, those are the types of things that if you don't have those relationships to truly educate and understand for each other, how important that is, that position is, the rest fails.
I think that's a beautiful answer.
So
that also comes down again, what you said, you know, you have your house in order, right? Because the whole system is so complicated. If you don't have your house in order, it's just not going to work.
And that reminds me of one of the things that sets Christine apart, because like I said in the intro, you know, she has worked for 19 years in Cargill, but I got to know her only like after 17 years. I got a phone call from her and she said, look, do you want to participate in a small team talking about, you know, the new trading strategy of the business you're in? And I said, yeah, I mean, yeah, super interesting. And one of the key pillars that she was talking about was people management. And the thing is that we had a conversation like an hour. And I couldn't hug her, of course, but that is kind of the feeling I had. I said, look, finally, I found someone who has the exact same thoughts as me and has a real passion for people management, and especially for promoting trading in our part of the business. And I want to know more about that, because among traders, my experience is there aren't a lot of natural people managers. And there aren't a lot of traders who necessarily are really interested in things like recruiting and development of youngsters. You know, they want to trade, they don't want to be bothered with all that stuff. What is it that, why is that different with you?
I think actually we touched upon this as well some episodes back, where we say a good trader, maybe even a best trader, doesn't mean you're a fantastic manager, right? So I think that's where you see a difference, right? Sometimes you can better have, you know, somebody keep him the best man, keep him the best trader, instead of making that person also a manager. So yeah, what makes you different?
Yeah, I'll start by saying I think that there are a lot of fantastic trading managers that I've had in my career that are very different. So I definitely don't think it's one size fits all. I think,
no,
you know, what's made me be a great trading manager can be very different from others, right? what I will say specifically about me, I think it goes back a little bit to I wanted to be a teacher. I wanted to be a coach. I always wanted to develop people, right? And so I think from an early age, I always had that mindset of developing others. In fact, my college thesis, so I had to do a thesis at the end of my college to graduate in this honors program. And my college thesis I did on the personality types of collegiate volleyball players and how that translated to their success in the positions that they played and the teams that they were on. And I used Myers-Briggs of all things. I think when I think about things like that, I was always very interested in, you know, what makes people tick? Everybody's different. How do you get the best out of people, right? If you assume that everybody has value, then it's really how do you maximize the value that they bring? And for me, I would sit down with my new team, you know, coming into another new business or person I've just hired. And the first question I would ask them is, why do you like trading? Because I would want to know what got them motivated to get up every day and do trading, because it's, you know, it can be a very stressful job, sometimes a very thankless job. Sometimes the things you do have nothing to do with trading. And that's also what I wanted to know. If you could change one thing about what you do, what would it be? Right? Like, I would hate deal entry. Right. So if we had any way to make sure that we have merchant assistant doing my deal entry, like that would, for me, you know, but other people might say something completely different. You know, I really hate this about my job. Right. And so I think just truly sitting down and understanding the individuals on my team, why they like trading, what they didn't like about their jobs, what their career aspirations were. And so that they really, truly felt like I was there for them and not just for myself. Because at the end of the day, it was not ever about, like, there's this book, Drive by Daniel Pink, one of my favorite books, and that talks about the whole put the carrot in front of the horse versus, you know, push somebody from behind. And I just firmly believe that people will perform if they feel like they're supported. And if you're not constantly saying, I need you to hit this number, because often people will want to achieve an even higher goal if they feel like they have your support and they feel like you are truly invested in them. And so, I mean, I remember I came over to Oils when I was in North America, and that team was a pretty small team at the time. And their target the year before was like 10 million or something. Right. And I had decided I was going to double the target. And one of the guys on my team was like, you realize that's almost $2 million a month. You know, I'm like, yep, I can do math. That's almost $2 million a month, you know? And he's like, but it's, we can't even do one. I'm like, well, we can, right? And so then we sort of broke it down into like, okay, what do you want to achieve? And then, you know, he had sort of had his goal for his book. And I was like, well, if we multiply that by the people on the team, we're going to make 30. And I think that year we made like 34 million, right? And so I think sometimes it's also just making sure that they like have very tangible goals that they truly believe in. And a lot of focus on the development too, Martijn. Right. You know, I was known for monthly trader development meetings, which would have a wide range of topics. Right. Maybe we're actually learning about options trading. Maybe we're, you know, learning how to code in Python. Maybe we're learning about AI. Maybe we have somebody coming to talk to us about how Red 2 in Europe is going to work. Right. Like, variety of topics. But I also always had that on the forefront. And maybe it's because I wanted to be a teacher, you know. Maybe it's because I've coached a lot of sports. I've coached quite a lot of sports, and so I think some of those, you know, personal side of my world also came into the trading side. Again, surround yourself with good people, and good things are going to happen.
That's a great,
she's combo. Great, Alex.
Yep, she's really good. But I think actually that you wanted to become a teacher, maybe actually that drive that you want to help people. You know, I think teachers always have, like, for me, they always, like, I look up because they're like, they do something really good for others, and I think they're always underpaid. And I think if you have that drive in you and combine that with, you know, now in this case, then trading, I think you get a little amazing combo that is fantastic for any company. Right. Yeah. So I think that's also really, really, really good.
I want to move to an important topic, and it's related to this, and it is also related to, you know, the fact that we want to take the opportunity now with you here, and that is a note I made had that the last role that you had, that was global trading and risk management director for global edible oils and fats business. And you were leading a global team of 60 traders. Now, your trading performance was really good, obviously. Well, obviously, yeah, it was really good. But you're also very proud of the fact that you moved female representation in the trading team from 22% to 38%. Now, the thing what I never liked about these numbers and these things in the spreadsheet that I sometimes saw when I talked about it with HR is that at the end of the day, it's about people behind it, and opportunity and being a role model and showing to women that trading career is possible. It's possible in Cargill. Now, the question is, you know, how did you do that? And what were the challenges that you needed to overcome to manage this? And what advice do you give both to women who want to work in trading, but maybe also to other companies, other trading companies who want to have a better representation of women in trading, what they should do to achieve that?
Yeah, I think you know that this is probably a big passion area of mine, right? And why I'm so grateful that you were able to have me on as a female trader is females are still underrepresented in the trading space. And, you know, I think there's definitely reasons for it. But I think one of the reasons that I have been so passionate about it is I'm a female. And so just some of the experiences that I have had, they relate very heavily on me. You know, there was a study McKinsey did a few years ago, and, you know, they talked about moving the diversity needle, not necessarily female, but just any diversity needle you want to move to, like, have more of a representation in a certain sector. And they basically said, if you want to move the needle, oftentimes the ones that are actually going to move it the fastest are those that are diverse themselves, because they have the passion and the drive to do it, right? And do it at a faster pace, and or to not stop once they hit a barrier, because they know how important it is because they felt it, right? And so I think part of the reason that I was so involved with the Women's Network and, you know, the sponsor for women in trading and the trading leadership team, some of that was because I had felt it and experienced it. And I truly wanted to see more representation. I think one of the big ones is just standing up and being very vocal on some of the unconscious bias that I would hear. Again, I don't think that my experience at Cargill and across the industry, I don't think that a lot of the barriers that existed when I started trading exist today. I think, in fact, most of it is a lack of awareness on how, you know, something somebody might say or some of the environments or decisions are made are felt by females. I think that's a lot of the times why females aren't rising at the same rate or are dropping out of trading. One of the personal experiences I had, I was in energy. I was one of the top traders in the energy group. And so I always had, you know, really good results. Wasn't the big swinging trader yet. That didn't come until I moved over to agriculture. But, you know, I had gotten this new manager. And he pulled me aside and he was really direct and I really appreciated it. And he said, hey, and this was back when Cargill used to do the 9 box where you put people, I don't know if the audience is familiar, but basically it's a axes where, you know, going up is your performance and across the x-axis is potential. And I was in the 4 box. So I was performing. And they were recognizing that I was performing, but my past manager basically thought I had no potential. And so my new manager was like, yeah, any idea what he has you for? And, you know, he's like, here's the comments that are written about you. So he was this really great, transparent manager. He's like, they said you're aggressive, argumentative, and stubborn. And I just don't think that sometimes men and women's ways of working are perceived the same. I think I can say the exact same thing as a male counterpart, and I can be perceived as aggressive. Where when I'm looking for traders, I want somebody that's aggressive. I want someone that is willing to stand up for their position, that's willing to engage in a debate, you know, that's willing to hold their ground. I'm looking for those qualities, and to have those put on paper as something that was negative to me as a trader and why I didn't have potential, I think was very damaging. And I think sometimes, I think I've seen that sometimes when I've looked at other female trader reviews for new teams that I've come in. So I think that's one of the reasons. You know, another thing that I noticed in my time is there's a lot of business done outside of hours on the relationship side of things. And so when you think about just the social interactions that you have with your your colleagues or your customers, a lot of those relationships are formed or solidified in, you know, industry events or, you know, go having beers after work. And sometimes where you choose to have those social events, golf course, bar, etc., aren't maybe the best environment for women to go to, or maybe they just don't want to put themselves in those situations. So I think too, you start to lose some of the, same footing as your male counterparts if you're choosing not to participate in some of those events. And I saw that happen time and again. So I think that was another one, right? There was one other female trader in energy early on. And so we'd go to these events and we would only be the two females. And we would always say, we're going to pass on this particular bar you're going to, which was more than just a bar, if you know what I mean. And we'll go get pedicures or something, right? And that's very stereotypical. But I do think you need to think about, you know, having these social engagements where a lot of those relationships are being formed, and relationships are so critical in merchandising and trading. I think it's super important to make sure that it's an environment that everybody wants to participate in. It's the same thing for somebody that doesn't participate in drinking alcohol, making sure that there's non-alcoholic choices for them. It's the same thing, right? You know, and then I think for challenges, one of the hardest things for me was hearing what I would perceive as excuses for why we didn't get more females in trading. Oh, the pipeline isn't big enough, or they're not ready yet. Imagine being a female listening to, you know, leadership of a company say, well, we don't have enough females in management positions because they're not ready yet. And you're a female that's been there for, let's just say, 20 years waiting for that opportunity. And you're basically hearing them say, well, she's not ready yet, right? Some of those rationales as to why we were not hitting targets, I hate targets, but why we were not moving the needle, I think really just needed to be challenged more, or making assumptions as to if it's the right time or fit for the female. I don't think I've ever heard that be said about one of my male counterparts, but, oh, well, we don't want to move her because she's having a baby, or they need to be 10 years in before we're thinking about an expat assignment. And then the problem is, well, now they are in a part of their situation where they're having a family. Now maybe they wouldn't want to move, but what if we gave them that experience at 5 years? Why do we have to wait till 10 years? Why do they have to make 3 moves before we give those assignments? Why can't we think outside of the box? You know, it doesn't have to be so prescriptive. And then also trying to thread the needle of making sure when you're the leader and you've hired female or a diverse candidate or whatever it is for that role, that you are super loud and clear that you hire them because you think they're the best for the job. Because the last thing that you want that person to do is to come in that role and to have other people thinking that they got that job just because they're diverse. And so I think it takes a really, really strong people leader and people manager to be vocally talking about just why they are super excited for hiring that person, because they truly are the best for the job and they believe that, truly believe it. So my advice is be open-minded to your candidate pool and their backgrounds. I mean, I have a very, very non-traditional background. I am so grateful for the managers that I've had that have hired me when I've had a background that has nothing to do necessarily with like that physical commodity or that physical business, but I had a proven track record, and what they needed was what experience I had, and they knew that I could figure out how to translate that experience, right? My big move to energy, to agriculture, would never have happened had it not been for Rich Torres, that trading manager I had, who told me, everybody you're going to be interviewing against is going to have a stronger background than you. So you better come thinking about how are you going to impress not just me, but everybody else, right? On what you're going to bring to the table. And the same thing, I mean, Martin, you know, Robert Horster, he hired me sight unseen. We had never met ever, but he heard about my background and he wanted to really transform that oil team into a trading team. And he thought I could do it based on what he had heard. And so be open-minded to the talent that you're hiring and their backgrounds. I would say be super courageous as a leader, because it's not easy to hire somebody that isn't the person that's been being groomed to be in that next role. It's way easier to say, yep, I'll take this person that's been, you know, working up the traditional route. And sometimes those people are needed too, but be courageous when it's not those people, and then be vocally supportive. Set them up for success.
I think this part of the podcast is going to be on repeat a couple of times for many people. because there's so much good stuff in it that people really need to digest and think about. Hey,
I digest as well, and I think you gave some really, really good, arguments. But what I'm interested in as well is, like, because I see so many guys interviewing for these roles as traders, and there are luckily also ladies, and I think that the females and also the female group becomes larger. But if you would say, is it why, because would you say that it's so great, this job as a commodity trader? Why is it so amazing? Why would you promote it if you would send for one of your events that you organized for women? And you'd say, well, you know, this job, trading job, is so amazing. What would be your story? What would be your speech?
Yeah, I guess some of the experience I've had have not been great, right? It is not for everybody. I mean, I would start by saying trading is not for everybody.
No.
I actually disagree with Martijn on why I come to trade every day. I come to win. I don't come to just manage risk or not make mistakes. I'm not saying that you do that, Martijn, but I come to win, and I like winning. And so, you know, I think there is this part of, are you competitive? Do you like to come every day to try to basically, you know, beat the market or win, right? Because if you don't want to come every day and really challenge yourself to learn something new, challenge yourself to be, you know, better than the next person, this is probably not for you, because it's a lot of work. It's not just doing something on repeat every day. It's not just checking off boxes in a task. And so I think that eliminates a lot of people.
Yep.
So step one, really evaluate if it's for you and what that means, because it's basically like coming to challenge yourself and do something new and win every day. And then if that sounds appealing to you, then I would say it's one of the best jobs in the world, because every day is different. You have no idea how your day is going to go. You don't know what's going to be thrown at you. But the combination of the excitement, the pace, the ability to use both your intellectual capacity as well as your soft skills on the relationship side. I probably haven't emphasized enough how important it is to have those relationships with brokers and customers and clients and your colleagues, right? I think it's very hard to find a role that has that combination every single day. And to me, I just enjoyed it. I miss it right now, right? I miss that.
Are you coming back?
I don't think I'm done yet.
Very cool.
I think it has been, I think it was a fantastic choice for me to step away from the role I was in. But I don't know if I'm done yet.
Cool. Okay, well, let's see. I would be amazing to have you back, of course, here. I have another one, and maybe that's a bit outside the box, but you said you have four kids. You have a husband that works as a trader as well. As traders, we also travel a lot, right? We travel around the world, etc. How did you find that with managing a family as well, the traveling and the timings, etc.? How did you experience that? Because, of course, a lot of jobs, they have sometimes longest hours, etc. But it's different when you are a week away to Malaysia to go to the fields and, well.
Yeah, I enjoyed the travel. I'm a very strong E. I'm a people person. And I love different, you know, cultures in that time. So when I was traveling, I thoroughly enjoyed it. And so grateful to have those experiences and be at a company, you know, and be in positions where I was able to do that. The travel's tough with kids, you know, and for as much as I thought, and this is going a little bit off topic on trading, but for as much as I thought that it was challenging when they were young, right? I had four under five you know, and I still remember coming back to work after my fourth child and getting a call like 3 hours into my first day back, you know, after being gone and, you know, maternity leave in the US. I finally took 12 weeks with my fourth child, and now I think they get 14. But like my first, I took 6 because I was so worried about, you know, nobody had ever had a baby in energy trading before, and I was worried they were going to give my job away. Well, they couldn't. Anyways, so I just come back after having my fourth child. I had been at work like 3 hours, and I get a phone call from daycare, and one of my kids is sick.
Oh, God. Yeah, there you go.
And you're just, it's that moment where you're like, I'm really trying to have this professional career, but I'm also a mom, and I, you know. And my husband was really great, and we worked through those challenges. But, you know, the travel when they were young was not nearly as hard as the travel the last couple of years. Coming out of COVID, more so because of two things. One, COVID all of a sudden put us all at home. And so my kids became very accustomed to me being at home, right? Even though I'd like be in my office during office hours, which we could have created an entire, you know, TV series by just putting a camera in our house for those COVID times when I had my four kids, they're all in Spanish immersion and they're all like on their iPads learning. And my husband and I, and my husband's, we got broker squawk boxes and it was chaos. But,
and 20 screens, you know, in the house.
It was, oh, you know, we lost internet all the time and it was a disaster. But what I, on the trading side, when I had to go back to travel, coming out of COVID, that was really tough on my kids because they were so used to me not traveling. And then just their ages now, they just need emotionally a lot more time from me than they did when they were little. When they were little, they needed me to like change their diaper and, you know, help get them dressed and brush their teeth. And now they're their own people in their own worlds and they're, you know, figuring out who they're going to be. And that's a really important piece of being a parent too. And so, you know, that time away became challenging. And it definitely wasn't the reason I left Cargill. I mean, I can tell you candidly, there's three filters I always used when I was looking at roles, right? I had 9 roles in Cargill over 19 years. And there were some roles I said no to, including the last one, and some ones that I said yes to. But the filters were always, is this a role that is exciting to me or could be exciting to me? Like, is it interesting? And the second one was, is what I'm good at, because I'm not everybody's cup of tea. You know, I told people I like to rock the boat. Like if you're going to hire me, I like to rock the boat, but people love to work with me. But you have to know I'm going to rock the boat. But also in the third filter, is this worth spending time away from my other priorities? And I couldn't say yes to any of those three. And that's why I ended up leaving. And so, yes, family was a part of it. The travel was challenging and it was a lot at the end, right? I was global. So I was, you know, traveling globally every month. But it wasn't the only thing by far. And I'm maximizing the time while I'm not traveling globally now and making those memories. And Nice. Who knows where I'll end up next. Yeah.
Thanks.
What direction are you thinking about? Because in terms of trading, and the good news is you can trade from home or like, well, you can call it investing or trading, you know, stock market, you know, whatever you want to do. Which have you thought about that? So what are your thoughts? Or maybe it's
Martin, I've been all over the board with what I'm going to do next. You know, I spent a couple months just not doing anything on purpose, right? Just sort of enjoying the pace and probably driving everyone in my family nuts. And then I spent a couple months exploring the nonprofit space pretty hard. So another piece of me is I've always been very involved in the nonprofit space. You know, I sit on the board of a couple nonprofits here in Twin Cities, Big Brothers Big Sisters Twin Cities, on the board of the local softball association. And then most recently, I just joined on the Minnetonka Public Schools Foundation board. So I spent a lot of time actually exploring, do I want to make that transition over to the nonprofit sector for a bit and run a nonprofit? You know, I think what I came to realize is I really like making money, not so much asking for it. Not that there's anything wrong with that at all, but like I really like making money, right? That's fun. And as you know, I started a blog. I've only published one. Maybe someday you'll get to see the full version of it. It's called Mom Thoughts, Boss Lady Edition. So maybe someday I'll get enough courage to publish it all.
I'll do it.
A little bit of consulting stuff. I've got, you know, actually a big one coming up. Christine. But the piece that's missing to me, Martin, I'm missing the being and managing people and leading people. And I'm missing the true trading component. I will say I've got a managed PA and I've been probably annoying the heck out of the person managing it as I've become more actively involved because I've got the time to do it. So I don't know. It's still up in the air and I'm enjoying the journey.
I think your phone is going to ring a lot after this podcast, after we publish it. Before I forget it, I know we are moving a bit to over time already, I think. But one thing I made a note when you made that very, very interesting comment about your drive to promote more women and the things that you have experienced. And while you were saying that, I thought, hey, you know, we are in the business of taking risk. And as a trader, you're never ready, right? You have to get used to the fact that, okay, you spend all the hours analyzing, doing the numbers, talking with your peers, and it is rare that you think, yeah, I have 100% confidence in a trade. Now, you should think about the same way with people, yeah. And in fact, you know, we as grown-ups, I think all of us still look at the way we live our lives. Are we ready? Are we actually ever going to be ready? No, there's so many things that you're not ready, and the excitement is doing it anyways, like you with your business, and maybe me with leaving Cargill, and Megan making the podcast with us. Yeah, no one of us.
It's a roller coaster. It's a roller coaster. Right?
And so I think that, you know, to trading companies and to managers, we should more often say, well, look, approach it as a trade. Yeah, it is a risk. Maybe you feel she's not ready, but give her that trust and confidence. And what is also critical as a manager, you have such a big role in helping someone. It's like you throw them in the deep and then you leave them. No, you are the one who can support them and make them successful, right? So I find that, And the thing is, as I told you also, I wasn't aware of these things, to be frank, right? I mean, yeah, and I think many male traders are not aware of the things that women experience and maybe opportunities that they don't get. And that's why I think it is important that we now have this podcast and that you can express your experience and that people should, yeah, listen up and do something.
But I think that what you say is actually everybody, when we ask about what made you successful, right? And what you say, Christine, I mean, is about people, the team. I think a lot of people said that, right? From in the podcast, top managers, board, etc. So I think they all said, well, I have a team and they're also different, right? You need a diverse team, preferably from different countries, different cultures, but also female, male, et cetera. Why? Because everybody agrees that a team that is super strong makes you super successful in trading. And then I think, you know, female and male is just one part of it, just like maybe different cultures, because maybe people in the US are, well, maybe they're different than, I don't know, somebody here in the Netherlands, right? So you want different people that have different attitudes, different backgrounds that can create that amazing trading team that everybody's seeking for. All right.
At the same time, and that's also good, what Christine said. Look, it's not for everyone, and I think it can be a brutal job, huh?
Yeah, but it counts also for. I also have seen guys crying on the trading floor. So yeah?
I've seen that.
Yeah. Well, you know what's interesting about that comment? I actually think females are less emotional traders than men. Which is the opposite of, you know,
I think actually
stereotypical norms.
Yeah.
But I think it's true.
It's a very good point. It's a very good point.
And I actually think that's a strength.
Absolutely.
To be able to,
you know, there is how many times have we seen research that women are better investors, than men? Yeah.
I don't know what research you're pointing to, and maybe that's true. All I can tell you is from my experience. It seems like, and probably one of the things that's made me pretty good, I can keep my emotions completely out of it. I'm completely separated emotionally from the job. One of the best traits of a trader is having a short memory. If you can't come in every day with a clear mindset, if you're still thinking about what happened yesterday, you know, maybe you held on to a trade too long, maybe you're still rationalizing, you know, out of your analysis.
Oh, I all did
that. Struggle.
I all did that. No, all right. We come to the end, Christine, of the podcast. We're already there at the hour just to end it. I very much enjoyed it, Christine. I really liked it. I think it was really cool. I think also what you said at the end, I wanted to win and I want to make money. That's where I'm good at. I think you know so well where you're good at and what you want. I think that's amazing. And I think, yeah, your combination, I think, of a teacher with your commodity trading and the you know, your background, I mean, that's an amazing combination as well. Maybe happened coincident, but I think it's thank you very much for all your for all your answers and your time. Really appreciate it.
I would like to raise one more question.
You go for it. Hey.
Yeah, because look, one of the reasons why I wanted to have Christine in the podcast is because I thought, okay, she is a role model. She's going to be a role model for women who consider a job in finance, trading, commodity trading. Now, and I think based on what we have experienced in this podcast, I think she is, and that is great. So job well done. Now, my last question is, who is yours? Who is your role model? Who do you admire?
Oh, I like this last question.
Oh, that's a great question. My mom.
Moms always winners. Yeah, you're done.
What's interesting? No, but do you know what's interesting about my mom? We're so different. And she doesn't apologize for who she is. So she actually went to be a teacher, probably why I wanted to be a teacher. I was the oldest, had me, chose to be a stay-at-home mom. Later in life, she worked with people with disabilities because she's just this super caring, puts everybody before herself, you know, very humble. You know, she'd do something at the drop of the hat for anyone. And I am very, you know, black and white, you know, hard-nosed, driven, found my way into the, you know, and I also don't apologize for who I am because I think that's what's gotten me to this point. But what we both have in common is she always taught me to be a good person. Beyond anything else, be a good human. Oh, I'm going to get emotional. But yeah, my mom is amazing and incredible. And even though we are so different, you know, she's always had that support for me. And I think that's what people need and probably why I'm at where I am today.
That's amazing.
It's a cliche answer.
No,
that's a thanks.
Mom, right? So mom, Christine, if you're listening to this commodity podcast that you maybe don't care about at all, you're amazing.
I've got to teach her. I've got to teach her how to listen to a podcast first, Alex. So might need to go there. But
all right.
Okay, on this fantastic note, on this high note, thanks a lot. It was fantastic.
Yeah, really cool. Thank you very much, Christine.
Thank you both for having me.